thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action All the Time. As we kick off our brand new season, looking at the 90s films of Kurt Russell. I'm one of your hosts, Scott Murphy, and just to clear up any confusion, we will not be looking at all of Russell's 90s films, just the action ones. So we shall not be covering Unlawful Entry, Captain Ron, or his uncredited cameo in Forrest Gump, but we shall be covering everything else, starting with 1991's Backdraft. Now, this is the point I usually introduce one of my regular co-hosts, Kyle or Craig, or both of them. However, they are both currently on top secret assignments, so couldn't make it. I did call in a Ghost of Wait director, Adam Stovall, who you might remember from the Copland episode we did last season, but unfortunately, some last-minute ghost-busting scuppered that as well. No worries, though, as swooping in like Batman to save the show, we have YouTuber and friend of the show, Caleb Knutson. Hi, Caleb.
Well, I am not a director, and I'm not anyone famous, but I did look at the fire, and the fire looked back at me, so I'm ready to do this.
Well, that's good enough. Good enough for me. Good enough for this show, for sure. And you did so well in the Demolition Man episode. We had to have you back.
And it was a blast. So I'm excited to talk more 90s action films. I'm disappointed that we're not covering Forrest Gump for just that little uncredited cameo of Kurt Russell's, but we'll start with Backdraft here.
Yeah, it's just a 2-second episode. Like,
he was Elvis, right?
He was Elvis.
Yes.
Exactly. So, as always, a little bit of background before we get into this one. Backdraft was released in U.S. cinemas on May 24th, 1991, so is therefore celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. It was directed by Ron Howard, whose notable credits include the likes of Apollo 13, Cocoon, Splash, Willow, a bunch of other stuff. And it was written by Gregory Whitten, whose notable credits include writing the initial script for Highlander, writing and directing the Christopher Walken horror movie Prophecy, and he also wrote the 2019 sequel to this film, Backdraft 2. Which you probably don't know about, but yes, Backdraft 2, it exists. Review-wise, Backdraft is currently sitting at a 6.7 on IMDb. It is sitting at a 74% on Rotten Tomatoes, based on 47 reviews, 38 on Metacritic, based on 12 reviews, and a 3.1 on Letterboxd. It also made $152.4 million off a $40 million budget, making it the 11th biggest film of 1991. Can you guess what film beat it into the top 10?
I will... I'm going to guess Silence of the Lambs?
It was not Silence of the Lambs. Silence of the Lambs was bigger than that. No, it was Sleeping... No. It was... It was Sleeping with the Enemy as what beat it to the number 10 spot. Also, it was Backdraft was just ahead of the number 12 spot that was City Slickers. So in between Sleeping with the Enemy and City Slickers.
Okay. All right. This
is also, it's definitely the only film we've covered so far that was also a theme park attraction. It might not be the only movie we cover that is also a theme park attraction, but so far, this is the only one. It was an attraction between 1992 and 2010 at Universal Studios Hollywood, but still exists at Universal Studios Japan in Osaka. So you can, if you're ever in Osaka, you can go to the Backdraft theme park attraction. Like, I think it's just, you go into a building, it's like a burning building. I think
it starts off on the boat where you get drunk and then you drive to work where you put on the fire suit and then you go fight fires.
Yes.
I think that's where it starts.
I'm pretty sure if we went to Universal Studios Japan in Osaka, that is exactly what we would find.
Yeah.
So all joking aside about your swooping in like Batman, you actually requested to be on this episode, Caleb. So tell us about your relationship with the movie Backdraft.
Yeah, before we recorded, you were talking about how you were surprised that someone was like wanted to talk about Backdraft. I grew up with this movie. This was one of the VHSs that we had growing up as a kid. And this actually belonged to my younger brother, who growing up when we shared a room, when we shared bunk beds, this was always on because we had to keep him entertained and keep him happy. Mm. Which was, you know, strange because he was like 7 at the time and this film is rated R, but he always wanted to be a firefighter. He always wanted to be a fireman. But he couldn't, for whatever reason, couldn't say fire truck. He would always say fire fruck. It was one of the best things that came from him. But yeah, so I watched this almost repeatedly for a couple of years in the late 90s as we were moving around and I was sharing a room with my brother. So going back and watching this, because I hadn't watched it ever since then. So it's been like a good 20 years since I've seen this film, but popping it in for this retrospective, everything came right back to me. I'm like, yep, I remember every cadence of the lines that are being said here, the way the people are looking at the screen, the way Kurt Russell's cheeks shake whenever he's intense and pushed up against the wall. I remember everything.
Yeah, I was surprised by how much I remember. Like, just listening to your story as well, I'm just reminiscing about, like, I also have a little brother and who I also shared a room with. So there is certain movies that he watched all the time that are etched in my mind, like particularly Toy Story and The Lion King were big ones with my little brother. But yeah.
Anything to keep the younger brother happy.
Yeah.
For you, it was Disney. For me, it was rated R Ron Howard films.
Yeah. I mean, like, there was other ones as well. Obviously the rating system is different here, but there was kind of rated R ones that we watched together as well because I was an irresponsible older brother. We watched a lot of Arnold Schwarzenegger movies together. So like Terminator 2 and Total Recall and The Running Man were in regular rotation.
Nice. And, that Terminator 2 was the big winner over this movie at the Oscars, I believe.
Yes, for visual effects and,
the sound and sound editing.
Design and, yeah. Because I was thinking, yeah, like it was, and because the visual effects in this movie are great, but like, yeah, I suppose Terminator 2. It did have a bigger budget, like a much bigger budget.
Oh yeah. Now, when you watch this for this review, I had a Blu-ray that had a little like 3-minute introduction from Ron Howard, and he was talking about the visual effects supervisor, Alan Hall, how they were dealing with the, you know, real life fires because they tried doing digital. This was a couple of years before Jurassic Park really knocked it out of the park. Yep. No pun intended. Yep. But yeah, Alan Hall was doing all of like the live fire. So how did you view this? Did you have that or did you look that up or?
That introduction.
Yeah.
No, I didn't see that introduction. I rented it. Rented it, stream. No, that's actually not true. It's available, currently on Netflix UK. So I didn't rent it. I just watched it on Netflix.
Well, I know that Backdraft 2 is available on Netflix here in the States. I did not, though, take the journey and watch that. I did read the plot synopsis, and I'm glad I did not waste my time.
I also read the plot synopsis, and also watched the trailer. And I probably would have watched it, to be fair, I get so obsessive about these things. I probably would have watched it as part of the research, but I ended up not, because the only way you could watch it is if you couldn't even rent it. You had to buy it. And I was like, I was like, I am not spending £6.
Nope. Not a single cent is going towards that sequel. I'll use it for the original, but the direct-to-DVD sequel, mm-mm.
No. Made 28 years after the original.
William Baldwin looks way more like Alec Baldwin now.
Yeah.
In that trailer.
Yeah, for sure he does. It is kind of weird though, because much like you, it's been about 20 years since I last saw this movie. I saw it a few times as a kid and in my teens. But it was surprising to me how much I remembered of it. Like Kurt Russell in the boat, like some of the main explosions, and just different things like the Donald Sutherland character. Like, yeah, there was a lot of scenes that I was like, oh yeah, this seems familiar. Yeah, yeah. Huh. Weird.
I feel like everyone who's ever watched this movie has that same reaction, because it's not an action movie that's like a tentpole of any one of these actors, or even Ron Howard's, or heck, even Hans Zimmer, who did the music. It's not like a tentpole film of theirs that people go like, oh, you remember when they were in that film or they worked on that film? But it's also one of those, like, when you see it on, or if you see it pop up, you go, oh yeah, I remember that one. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely feel the same way. Yeah, it's a very kind of middle of the road film for kind of everybody involved. It's not, like you say, it's not kind of seen as kind of top tier Ron Howard necessarily. It's not, obviously, when you think Kurt Russell, you often think of like the Carpenter collaborations, like so Escape from New York, The Thing, Big Trouble in Little China, you know, things like that. There is just certain things that spring more to mind, and other things we're going to cover in this season, like Tombstone, which we will cover next week. But it's a decent, it's a decent, solidly made film. And to be fair, it feels like it's a very Ron Howardy film, because like, if there has ever been a middle of the road director, it is Ron Howard. And I do not mean that disrespectfully, because I worked out today, I have seen in total 17 Ron Howard films. And why I might not necessarily love any of those films, I certainly like a bunch of them.
Yeah, he's one of those, like, solid directors where if a studio hires him on, it's almost guaranteed that, yeah, it's going to be a good film. It's not going to be a train wreck, and there's not going to be any, like, weird scandals or weird stories coming from sets. Everyone's going to be happy and get along with each other. It's going to be at least pretty good. And yeah, he's one of those directors, you look at his filmography and you go, oh, wow, I have actually seen a ton of his stuff. Cinderella Man, Apollo 13, that happened a couple of years after this. You mentioned before we started recording A Beautiful Mind, even going all the way up to a couple of years ago with him being called in by Disney, and Kathleen Kennedy to direct Solo, A Star Wars Story. Yeah. Because that one was in shambles and in trouble, and they were like, we just need a solid kind of just medium director to get this thing done, and that's Ron Howard.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, Solo was like another example of that, of like Solo, Star Wars Story. It ain't a train wreck. It's not particularly memorable, but when you watch it, you enjoy it, and then when you stop watching it, you kind of forget what happens.
Yeah, or you kind of forget about it, and you just move on, and you're like, that was a good time, but, you know, what's for dinner?
Yeah. Yeah. And I do have to say, as a kid, you know, I liked kind of fantasy films and stuff like that, so I do have, like, a soft spot for the likes of Willow. Which gets a lot of shit from people.
Who gives that film shit? No one.
Okay.
Willow is great.
Yeah. I really like Willow. And also, like, I like Tom Hanks comedies from the 80s, so I was also a big fan of Splash as a kid.
I have not. It's one of the few Tom Hanks I have not seen, unfortunately. I hear everyone enjoy, but I've gotten around to watching, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, like, everybody thinks of Tom Hanks, the respectable Oscar-winning actor, but, like, I really like that period in his career when he did, like, Splash and Big and Dragnet and Turner and Hooch and all these kind of movies. Yep.
Yeah, golden stuff. The Man with the Red Shoe or whatever.
But we should probably start talking about the plot of this film.
Okay.
Before we go off on any more tangents.
Sure.
So how does this movie open?
Well, the movie opens and we have a short little brotherly skirmish between the two McAfee brothers and their children. They're hanging out in a firehouse and, you know, they're arguing, they're playing, they're fighting with each other. And then all of a sudden their dad, who is the, I don't know if he's the fire chief or he's the leader of the firehouse, and they're getting called in for a fire. And Dad McAfee invites Brian, who is the younger one, who will later be played by William Baldwin, to come and see him get a special award for, I guess, going or putting out a record number of fires or something, whatever. He comes along.
Yeah.
They go into the, so they get to the fire, they go into the building, and Daddy McAfee is saving, all these people out the window, and he's like a rock star. But then all of a sudden, the monster of this movie peeks out over the roof, and the fire breaks through, and this little, adorable little kid who, if you've ever seen any of those claymation Christmas cartoons, around Christmas time, this kid is the live action version of that. He's missing teeth. He's got the rosy cheeks and the goofy little smile and the bowl cut. He's great. But there's a massive explosion. The building goes up and Daddy McAfee is killed. And then, the McAfee brothers they're orphaned. The fire ate their dad. It got to their dad. And then it becomes kind of like a revenge kind of monster movie after that, or at least partly a revenge monster movie after that. And we shoot forward many, many years into the future, where both the McAfee brothers are adults. And
yeah, I just wanted to quickly interject. So, like, yeah, as you said, it is part revenge monster movie. It is also part firefighter action movie. It is also part sibling rivalry family melodrama. It is also part political conspiracy thriller. And it is also part kind of mystery procedural. Yeah.
This film goes in many different directions, and at points where the scenes transition from one to the other, you go, what movie am I watching? Because it was one thing at one point, and now we're doing political espionage. What? What is going on here?
We will talk about the many things we do like about this movie that are generally all centered around the performances, the effects, and the stunt work. But the screenplay for this movie is nuts.
It's pretty frickin' crazy. I wish I knew what they were going for. It was like at one point they're trying to make that, you know, the first big action movie of the 90s or something. But then the other part is like, we're trying to be Oscar baity here. I don't know where the melding happened.
I don't know. Yeah.
But Daddy McAfee, I never realized growing up, was that Captain McAfee, I forget what I've been calling him this entire time.
I think he's actually played by Kurt Russell. I think he's Chief McAfee.
I don't know. Yeah. The leader of McAfee who dies here in the first 5 minutes, he's played by Kurt Russell, who plays Stephen McAfee, later on in the film, one of the brothers, which I never knew that growing up.
Yeah.
It was, so I saw it on screen, I'm like, what?
this movie is also part secret time travel movie where Kurt Russell's his own dad.
Whoa. This blew my mind. They were trying to compete with Terminator 2 that year.
Yeah.
Let's send Daddy McAfee to the past to have, so that he can conceive himself in the past so that he can live in the future. I get it.
It's very clever, this movie. It's very layered. I also like this opening scene because I realized when watching this opening scene and we see Brian see his dad die, and it's like he's watching him save people and stuff, and it's like this heroic music playing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like watching it being like, oh yeah, you could totally watch this movie with your eyes closed and still know the beats in it, because like the score is so heavy-handed that it tells you precisely what emotions you are supposed to be feeling at any given moment.
Yeah, it's bright brass all here, triumphant. It sounds patriotic. It sounds, very, very heroic. But then when that fire breaks through the roof and you just see a little glimpse of it, all of a sudden you hear the strings come in and it goes, da-da-da. Brian's the only one there who sees it. And she has this look on his face of like, guys, dad, look out.
Yeah.
Not to laugh over a kid losing his father, but.
No. It's done in a particularly corny. We're laughing at the corny way it's framed, not so much the.
I do love, I don't know if you caught the hippie dude or the hippie owner of the building.
Yes.
But as the firefighter's running through, he's like, guys, you gotta get to the second floor. The whole world's up there. My stuff is up there. Guys.
Like, I don't know why, but like, I did notice that as well. And it is such a small, nothing part that they literally could have got anybody. But that part is played by David Crosby of Crosby, Stills and Nash fame.
No shit. I didn't even bother to look that up. It was just a random guy. Well, no shit, you say.
Yeah.
Wow.
Ron Howard maybe knows him. I don't know. It's the most random
just
thing.
Stumbled
like,
on set
who
one
do we
day,
need
I guess.
For this one random part that has just basically needs to walk on and walk off. Let's call David Crosby.
What? Why not? It's actually probably David Crosby, and that was actually his apartment. The whole world's up there, guys.
He didn't know a film was being made. He's like, what the fuck is going on?
This was an actual fire. And Ron Howard's like, ooh, they're actually doing it? Let's just go shoot. So the opening here, this is our first glimpse into that monster aspect of how Ron Howard is portraying fire to what I think so well in this film. This fire is like Jaws, or like just that the alien creature, the xenomorph creature kind of lurking around the corners and kind of sneaking out underneath the door frame before finally exploding and sinking in the kill. This is our first little glimpse of that. And I love how they portray the fire in this film.
It's real. I mean, it makes no goddamn sense, but it's real fun. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. Makes no sense.
But, then we move on. We cut to 20 years later, landing in the year 1991, where Kurt Russell has already become his own father.
He's already become his own self. but Brian McAfee, little Brian who saw his dad, die in the fire and got his picture taken, by Life magazine. He's now grown and he has graduated from the fire academy. He is an official, probationary firefighter, Brian McAfee, which I guess it's not his first time doing it. I don't know if he graduated the first time or.
I'm not sure. Like it's not made clear whether he flunked out or he just didn't complete the course or he did. He made it, but then he quit or it's never made clear.
They make the point though that, Brian, he's kind of just that wandering family member, the firefighting's been in this family for a generation, but Brian, for whatever reason, feels like he could never do it properly, or that he never just gets the heroic recognition. So he either quit or he flunked out the first time and then went to go do a bunch of just crappy random jobs after that. But now he's back and he's actually graduated and he's looking for a nice, easy fire station to be a part of.
Yeah. There was something that kind of confused me about this scene. This like bar scene, his graduation scene of like, so he bumps into, the character Jennifer, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh. And, they have like a little conversation where Brian kind of comes across as a douchebag. And she says that he's been gone for 6 years, right? So like at that point, you kind of assume that like he has been outside of Chicago for 6 years, which is fine. But like 2 seconds earlier, he had a conversation with a barman who's like busting his balls about all the jobs he flamed out in and like looking through all of his business cards that for some reason he has on the board at the back of the bar. And it's like, so did he send him those business cards over the years? Like, what is the relationship with the barman? Did he keep coming back to that one bar and not visit any of his former friends or relatives in Chicago, but like, just was like, this is the new thing and I'm up to, you know, like, but you know, I've had my drink now. I'm off again.
It's a good question. I'd never even realized that of all the times I've watched this movie. maybe the best thing I'm coming up with is maybe, you know, cause he was, you know, like a salesman and like an insurance salesman, a car salesman. Maybe he was in Chicago for a conference and then just came by the bar and, cause he knew the bartender. I don't know.
That barman's got like 4 different business cards from him of like, oh, this time you were selling cassettes and this time.
Oh, that's right. The cassettes too. Yes. I don't know. Yeah. You think that when she'd say, hey, you've been gone for 6 years, that he would go off and, like train to be a ninja or get like a superpower and then come back. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Or maybe he's just really good at avoiding Jennifer.
Yeah, maybe. But then like everybody else reacts like he's been away from time for 6 years.
Right.
Like when I don't know. It's
right. Well, cause after he meets Jennifer and they have their little awkward conversation, like, oh yeah, I'm working at City Hall now. And, all that fun stuff. They go to a fire, his friend that he's also gone through the school with, Tim, probationary firefighter Tim. They go to a fire that blew up was this a politician who this fire killed in this house, or was this like a wealthy businessman? I forget who this was.
So we found out much later in the movie that this guy, along with the two other guys who were kind of assassinated by fire, are like finance guys, like,
okay.
who kind of cooked the books for another character that we'll introduce sometime.
During this opening bar scene, we cut to what seems to be a random guy walking up to his front door, and as he opens the door, we hear the backdraft fire sound and go shoo, and the entire house explodes. It turns out that guy is part of a big political scam later on, but
and for a long time he's not named. We do not know who the fuck he is.
Nope. We don't really know any of what the conspiracy stuff is. We just know that there is some mayor guy who's talking like, you gotta solve this case, De Niro, come on. And De Niro's like, hey, you talking to me? Fuck you.
Well, this is kind of cool because, like, you know, talking about De Niro, like, this is still in the time where De Niro was just like hired as an actor to be in movies. Like, because I think the point of where he becomes quote unquote De Niro, It's like when he does like analyze this and then like meet the parents, and then he's kind of hired to be De Niro, not just like a character in a movie. But at this stage in his career, he's still being hired to just be a character in a movie.
Right. He actually has a name and a certain characteristic that he has to perform.
Yes.
Yeah, because the year before this, he was in what many people would consider one of the best films ever made, Goodfellas.
That is true.
And yeah, so he's still doing the acting thing. Before, you're right, he just is De Niro on set.
Yeah, but it's kind of more the turn of the millennium. He becomes just like, he just keeps getting hired to be like, oh, just be De Niro. Like, I'm not even sure if it's his choice or not. Like, it seems like he just keeps getting scripts and it's like, well, yeah, like, just do the, you look to me, you know, like, you know, do that thing. Yeah, okay, sure, I suppose. Yeah, but like, he gets a really, like, the characters are introduced real well, because Kurt Russell gets a real loving hero shot coming out of the building.
Oh, yeah.
And De Niro's introduction is cool as well, because he just looks kind of like really laid back and cool and kind of brooding. He's just kind of leaning against a car, smoking a cigarette, thinking deep thoughts, you know. So they both get cool introductions.
Yeah, he's sitting on the car and he's thinking, because the way that he approaches his investigation of the fire is that he's treating fire like it's a living, breathing thing. Like, it is that, you know, that naturalistic monster that he has to outwit and outthink and out whatever the survival mantra is, outlast or whatever. So he's trying to think, you know, he's just sitting out there like, yeah, how did you start? Where did you come from? What'd you do? But then Kurt Russell, who is our main topic here, and really the big brooding man, yeah, he gets the slow motion, walking through smoke, backlit, Hans Zimmer score swelling, and he's walking outside and he sees his brother for the first time, I think you're right, in like 6 years. So yeah, I think Brian has just been away.
He has just been away from Chicago for 6 years and has only had contact with that one barman. It's so weird. Yep.
Just the whole time.
Dear. But yes, at this point, we find out that Brian is going to be in the same company as Kurt Russell's character, Stephen Boole McCaffrey.
Yes, and Steve, I guess Brian attempted to bribe his way into another fire company, what seemed to be a safer fire company, with a bottle of scotch, and his brother Bull says, yeah, no, I called him, and you're going to be working with one of the hardest companies in the city, my company. And it has a great line there of like, one bottle of scotch, Brian, you're getting cheap in your old age.
It's really good.
Love that line.
And I love how the bribe half worked. Like, so he bribed the guy and to get transferred to another company and to see his exam results early. So the latter part did work. The former part did not. So like, kind of obviously not a trustworthy man who can be bribed, but also like not follow through with the bribe, or only follow through with half of the bribe. That's, he should definitely be investigated.
Yeah, he just got a bottle of scotch and reneged.
Yeah. I love the next scene as well, like, just after this, where, Brian goes to visit what he still thinks is Stephen's house, where he goes to visit Stephen's wife, Helen, and their child, Sean. And, we get this little moment where, like, he's like, hey, it's your Uncle Brian. You remember your Uncle Brian? And the kid gives him the shittiest, like, who the fuck are you? I don't like you. Fuck off, Luke. It's so funny.
It's meme worthy, it's screenshot worthy, but again, like what we were saying, this film is so just out of the pop culture zeitgeist of everyone's mind when it comes to like action movies. But yeah, if you pause it on this kid's face, I think he only went on to do like one other acting thing after that.
So.
You pause it on his face, the birth of Bitch Please. Who the hell are you? Get off of me. What? And there's also a hint of like, what are you wearing type thing.
Yeah, it's just like,
he has this little slurp like, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just various levels of disgust of like, what are you doing on my lawn? Yep. What's that look on your face? Why do you think you know me? What's this get up? I don't like any of what I'm seeing.
And then Brian also, he does an impersonation, and I've remembered this line ever since the first time seeing it, but he has like this little inside joke with this kid, who I guess laughed at it when he first saw him when he was first born or whatever. But Brian says, "Spinach? We don't need no stinking spinach." Do you know what that is a reference to? I never knew what that was a reference to.
I have not a goddamn clue. I was watching a movie with Barnan, and I was just like, I wonder if Caleb will know what that's a reference to. Maybe that's like an American thing. Maybe it's like from an American cartoon that didn't make it over here or something.
Maybe. But I always remember that line because I thought it was so ridiculous, but I've always remembered it. It's actually popped into my head every once in a while where I'm just like, spinach? Don't need no stinking spinach. Maybe it's like a Popeye thing? I don't know.
Yeah, no, that was my only thought. I was like, I don't remember Popeye like ever seeing that, but like
me neither. maybe it was the villain he always fought.
Pluto?
I forget. Was that the villain he fought?
Yeah.
I can't remember. Yeah? Maybe it was. I don't know. I just remember that line.
Yep.
Yeah. But yeah,
fun story, Caleb. Popeye, the Robin Williams film, is the first Robert Altman film I ever saw.
Whoa. Oh God, it's been so long since I've seen that thing.
We can't go in any more tangents, so we got to get back to this movie. I'm sorry.
Right. It's okay. Okay. But yeah, so the spinach line happens. He runs in. Brian meets up with Helen, who is played by Rebecca de Mornay, who I will always love seeing on screen. She was always one of my early day crushes. Several people probably know her from Risky Business. I'm one of the weirdos that remember her from the Disney film Three Musketeers. Any of you recall that one with...
That's going to be the bonus episode of this season. I just want to...
Spoiler! It was a surprise!
We planned that so well.
Kiefer Sutherland as a musketeer. It's great. But I loved her in that movie. And so seeing her here, I was like, oh, yes, I remember her. But yeah, she tells him that.
Actually, no, there's a streak that I feel like now you've got to be on the Three Musketeers episode because there's a through line here. Like this is one of the last tangents we'll go on. There is a through line here in terms of like, so you're on this episode, which stars Rebecca de Mornay, and you are also going to join us for the Executive Decision episode, which stars Oliver Platt. And, you know, because the films have to be connected, bonus films have to be connected in some way to the main season. And the connections are, obviously, Rebecca de Mornay and Oliver Platt appear in Three Musketeers.
That's right. That is absolutely right.
So I feel like you have to make that trilogy now.
Well, I will gladly talk about Three Musketeers, the Americanized version. Absolutely.
Okay.
Kiefer Sutherland, Chris O'Donnell. Oh yeah.
But coming back to this movie, so Rebecca de Mornay is entirely wasted in this film, much like Jennifer Jason Leigh is. Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's the 90s, it's an action film, female characters don't often get it best.
No, unfortunately, they're typically playing either the assistants or they're playing the wife or the person at home who's taking care of the family and who's always worried about the risky stuff that their action hero husbands or boyfriends are doing. So yeah, unfortunately, that's how action movies worked back in the 90s. But it's exactly what's happening here. We'll come to find out later on, but yeah, Helen doesn't like all of the risks that Stephen takes because he's reckless when he goes into a fire and tells Brian that he moved out many months ago and now he's living on what used to be their dad's boat, which I guess, as we've determined, is actually Kurt Russell's boat. So, yep. But yeah, and Brian.
Like Kurt Russell, like, cool character in this film. We've already established that he's a cool character with our loving Euroshot, but he's living on a boat. He's listening to Cream. What's not to like?
Nothing. Nothing. He's in a tank top. He's drinking beer. He was kind of trashing the boat, but he's just leaning back and he's without a care in the world. He's kind of living the life, even though he misses being with his family. At this point though, he's kind of okay with it.
He seems much less broken up than he will in about 20 minutes.
Right. But, so Brian goes out, talks to him on the boat saying, why did you change my station? Here, Brian gets a little glimpse of these canisters, that look like some type of fire accelerant, which we'll learn later is triptychlorate.
Yes.
Yes, triptychlorate.
Triptychlorate.
But it's just a kind of a throwaway thing, like, ooh, canisters here. That's weird. But yeah, they're
triptychlorate.
Yes. Yes. That apparently the doctors in the morgue have absolutely no idea what that is, which I find a little strange, seeing how a doctor, someone of the medical field who works with chemicals, doesn't know what a chemical is.
That's true. But anyway, that's pretty much that. But then we move on to Brian's first firefighting mission. And as throughout the movie, we'll probably talk about, pretty much all the firefighting scenes are exciting. They are fun. They also make no goddamn sense as hardly anybody, like, on the firefighting mission, Brian is the only person wearing breathing apparatus. Nobody else is wearing breathing apparatus. Everybody else is just going into the fire, you know, Steven, and everybody else is just going into the fire just being like, yeah, it's fine. But Steven is telling Brian that he needs to be wearing breathing apparatus. And it's almost like a thing of being like, ah, yes, because you're the weakling, so you need to be wearing the breathing apparatus. But everybody else, it doesn't matter.
I think Tim was wearing it, the other probationary firefighter.
Oh, yes. Okay.
I was thinking it was like a thing of
the newbies have to do it. But then when you become a real man, a real firefighter, you can just face it. It's, yeah.
You know, my mind was going into the, kind of like the safety route where I was like, well, they're new. They're not accustomed to breathing in smoke and fire a lot. So that's why they're wearing it. But I think more likely the reasoning in the script here is the reason that you're portraying is that these are newbies, Kurt Russell, everyone of Axe, everyone here who is established, we're all real men. We don't wear masks. That's right. I think you're right with that.
Yeah.
But
talking about Axe, right? So, Axe is played by Scott Glenn, who people will know for various things. Maybe younger listeners will know him as Styx from the Daredevil, the Netflix Daredevil series. I have a question, Caleb.
Oh, yes.
Do you think Scott Glenn is a vampire? Because he has always looked the same to me.
He has always looked this leathery, wrinkly old man going back to the 80s.
He's the same wrinkly old man though. He's 30 years later, he's 82 now. Like, he's still, he was born that way, he stayed that way. Like, I don't understand.
Because he was in Silence of the Lambs that came out a couple of months before this film was released.
That's right.
And he looked the same there. I think he is a vampire. Actually, he probably got like vampire skills or eating skills from Hannibal Lecter. So that he knew how exactly to, to scarf someone's eternal life or life essence into himself. But yeah, he always looks the same in everything.
Yeah.
Come to find out, he will be a much bigger player later on in this film.
Indeed.
But they kind of just like show him here and there, but he's not really in the forefront at all in the first half of this movie.
No, not at all. He's kind of like a figure to the side. Much of the first half. It's weird because like they kind of establish later that he's kind of been a little bit of a kind of father figure to Stephen and Brian. But they don't kind of properly establish it earlier on. So when it kind of comes up, you know, like they kind of do like in a kind of throwaway comment type way of like, I practically raised this kid, you know, and then it's like, but it's not, they don't really portray that relationship a lot.
Not really, other than really the only moment that we get is the opening death scene of Captain McAfee, because Axe is the one that was saved by their father, and he's running out of the building, hugging Brian when he was a kid because he knows that his dad is dead. But that's really all that we get. And then kind of slowly, we see him start getting a couple more lines in this scene and getting a little bit emotional with another line in this scene, to the point where you go, okay, I think they're finally showing us the villain here, or the person perpetrating what's going on in this movie.
Yeah. Oh, we know the real villain. It's fire.
Oh, it's fire. And then the fire in this opening scene, because I think we would watch this opening scene a lot, especially my younger brother, because he loved, again, being a fire or wanting to be a firefighter. And hearing this time around, hearing everything that's being said from Kurt Russell, it's in the walls, and then it bursts out of the walls like a velociraptor or something. I just love how they portray fire. It's like this own living thing that's out to kill everyone.
Yeah, but like I think it's even funnier when Brian goes off on this little solo mission because he thinks he hears somebody screaming, and then he kind of trips over his own feet, and then like the fire kind of sneaks out like a little grate, like a snake or something, and then like just and then just goes and engulfs the floor, and it's like, what is going on?
And he's okay.
Yeah, he's fine. He's fine, and he saves a mannequin.
We'll find out that this Brian character, the reason really why he wants to be a firefighter is to be a hero, is to be, I get, or maybe even just to have that recognition of, hey, I saved a life. Whether it's because he couldn't save his dad as a child in the fire, whatever you want, they don't really come out and say exactly why. He just wants to save someone. But he sees what looks to be a body on the ground and is so excited that I finally saved someone from a burning building, and brings it out. And I can only imagine if this was real life, the ribbing and all of the shit that he would be getting from all of his coworkers to find out that he actually saved a mannequin and not a real person.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine all the ridicule that he'd be getting.
Oh man. So bad. He'd be getting it so bad.
Now, but actually before that, there is the big firefighter moment though, that comes back many times, is the "if you go, we go" line that's mentioned. Yeah. So there's a moment where Brian falls down, or there's an explosion. He falls down. Someone walks over him and he's like, "Hey, help me." And the firefighter says, "Sorry, kid. I thought you were dead." And then a second later, the floor collapses and there's a firefighter who is hanging there for his life. And another firefighter is grabbing onto him. And he's like, "I'm going." And then they get the whole "you go, we go" line. And I'm just thinking, before you were so quick to say this probationary firefighter was like, "I thought you were dead. I'm sorry." But, and then here it was like, "Well, if you go, we go."
Team spirit, man.
I never noticed that growing up, but here I was like, that's kind of shitty.
Yeah, a little bit.
You make such a big deal about this "you go, we go" line.
Yeah, it's only you.
You go, we go. I just stepped right over you.
Yeah. Yeah. You only get the "you go, we go" if you know if you've earned your stripes.
But yeah, so the fire happens. You only get that one. But yeah, so the fire's happening. Brian comes out. He thinks he saves a mannequin, even though you'd think you'd feel how hollow she is or how stiff the body is. But yeah, saves a mannequin and is ridiculed for it. And then we're kind of coming down after the fire. And this is where we get our first little kind of interaction between the mayor character and Robert De Niro's investigative character, I think.
Yeah, we get a bit of interaction with them, and then who is played by G.T. Walsh, who will appear in a few films.
Oh, which one is that? McGee.
The alderman character.
J.T. Walsh, that's right.
It's played by G.T. Walsh, the late G.T. Walsh, who will appear in a few episodes.
Yeah, J.T. Walsh is like, hey, you gotta figure out what's going on here.
He is, and there is he says something to Kurt Russell about, like, his career, like, oh, the glow in your eye, that's the career line dwindling or something or other.
Yeah, so, yeah, J.T. Walsh, alderman, leans over to Kurt Russell and says something like, oh, you see the gleam in your eye, that's your reputation or your career going down the toilet or something like that. And Kurt Russell is being, is restraining himself, even though you can tell, like, he really wants to punch his lights out, because he's angry. Because Alderman closed one of the firehouses that was going to be the backup for this big fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's kind of two, like, really funny things I want to point out about this scene, because I think they're worth mentioning. One funny thing is, like, we get a shot of the burnt-out building where Axe and basically all of the fire crew are smoking in the burnt out building, which I find real hilarious. And yeah, also the other thing that I found hilarious in this scene was that for some reason, everybody's obsessed with Alderman's shoes. Like, De Niro mentions Alderman's shoes and Kurt Russell mentions Alderman's shoes. Like, it's just like a kind of thing of like, yeah. I just thought that was funny.
I was thinking it was like a, you know, again, this is, you know, bravado, a man's world, man's man type stuff, that if your shoes are, you know, nice and shiny, that means that you don't go out and do anything. You sit behind a desk safely or something like that.
Yeah.
He's talking about like, oh, you see those fucking shoes are like fucking butter.
that's a fair point. Yeah.
I do love that interaction of these firefighters smoking as they're, you know, breaking through everything and cleaning everything in this building. I just love that little touch. And I also love how they talk about Bull, how they talk about Steven as if he's like the fire whisperer.
Oh, yeah.
He's the only one that knows what a fire's thinking, and he never wears a mask. And from what I see, he never buttons up his jacket ever. Because he's just too cool, and he is too cool. That's why we're doing a retrospective on him. So
that is absolutely right.
Yeah,
I also love, like, it's a small scene that we don't really need to talk about, but again, it's just one of those ones that I just think is very funny to watch, where Brian and Bull are driving in a car back to Brian's home, and they're just listening to the song War in total stony silence. And it's just the fact you've got this really upbeat, funky song, and it's just like their grim stone faces. I don't know. It tickled me.
It's a little touch from Ron Howard, just making sure that the audience knows that, hey, they're brothers that really hate each other, but also love each other to death. And it's just this big tug of war between the two, in case you didn't get that originally.
Yes, absolutely.
I do love that little scene, though, because it just shows that I think these two have great chemistry with each other. It feels like these two are brothers, even though.
Yeah, for sure. I think they do. And yeah, they bicker in the way that kind of brothers do. Like, it's, yeah, everything here is, nothing here is subtle. Like, it is about as subtle as a bag of spanners being fired out of a cannon. You know, like, there's nothing, everything's heavy-handed, everything's melodramatic, but it's still fun to watch. It still kind of works.
Yeah, it's not annoying in any way. It's again, it's all fun. But yeah, so they drop off and kind of go about their lives for the next couple of days, I'm assuming, in the firehouse. Brian's actually doing the firefighter thing that he wasn't doing before, and brother's overseeing everything. Do we go right to the retirement party?
Yeah, we cut to the retirement party where,
yeah,
after seeming not that caught up about it, now, like, Stephen is, like, properly pining over Helen, and she watches him, watches her sitting at a table with another man, and then is watching her, like, dancing with this other guy and just getting shit-faced.
Yeah, he's drinking scotch or whiskey or whatever it is. And I do love a drunk Kurt Russell. He's quite funny.
He's
misplacing his cup and the glass is breaking. He's like, okay, just chill out.
He's just tripping over shit. Yeah.
It does suck though that his wife is there with another, I'm assuming another firefighter or another
guy
related to the firefighter.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so if that's the case, I mean, it sucks because you're going to bump into each other in these awkward situations. And Steven just does not handle awkward that well because he always needs to be the alpha male in everything, in every situation. Yeah. So they get in, there's a couple back and forths in this scene. Apparently Brian is in the paper because he saved the mannequin, but everyone thought it was real.
Because the rest of the fire crew save an actual woman, and the newspaper conflated the two things, and now it looks like Brian has been portrayed as a hero in the local Chicago paper.
And it's all just more embarrassment for Brian, and he's feeling, again, like he's not living up to his father's expectations and not living up to his brother's expectations. Even though Brian does not want to admit that Stephen has any impact on him at all. It's obvious that he absolutely does. I've been that middle child, that secondary child in a family line before, and seeing this brotherly love and frustration with each other, been there, know exactly where these two are coming from. But
That scene, I feel like is kind of like a kind of classic brother moment, because like, and it's one of the, as much as much of what happens in this film is melodramatic and silly, like this is one of the moments that really rings true to me of like that guy who is dancing with Helen talks shit about Brian, and then Stephen punches him out because a brother can talk shit about their brother, but not somebody else cannot.
Nope. If someone else does something wrong to my brother, it's I will lay into you. But I can lay into my brother all I want, and no one else can. But yeah, so they get into a little tussle, and then Brian sees it. He runs over and starts punching out the other like backup for this guy too. And I love these moments. I totally forgot about it, but Kurt Russell, like he's being pulled away and he's like, I'm fine. And then slowly goes back over and tries to start the fight again. He does it like three times. I forgot about it from not watching it, but little moments like that. I love it.
Yeah, no, it's so good because he plays it so well. Of just being like, I'm cool, it's okay. I've calmed down now. It's all good. It's all good. I'm not gonna do it. And then he just runs over and tries to smack the guy again and starts the whole rumble again. Oh, it's so funny.
I think even the last time, it looks like he's gonna go over and like shake his hand or apologize because he's like kind of slowly going over there and he's like, rah, rah, rah. Love it. So good.
As I know you're also a fan of wrestling, it feels very much like wrestling is. It's just like a classic kind of like, psych, no, fuck you.
This feels like the go home episode to a big pay-per-view fight where they have the two in the ring and then all the referees come down and they separate them and then one of them breaks out and then they start brawling and then they separate them again. Yep, that's exactly what this is.
Yeah. When they both have to sign the contract and I was like, oh.
And someone's going to flip the table. Yep.
Absolutely. Craig's away so I can make wrestling references all I want.
And Craig won't side mention like, I don't know what's going on.
Exactly. And then after that though, like Brian takes Steven back home, and this is the kind of the one moment where like you're kind of wrong footed by the score, because like basically they're having like this little kind of heart to heart of Bull is semi comatose because he's totally out of his mind drunk, and Brian is like, and then but like there's this kind of like upbeat kind of score going on. It's like very, very kind of peppy, you know, like very kind of, it's like, what's happening here? Where is this going? And then where does it go, Caleb?
It goes into one of the dumbest montage songs I have ever heard. I completely forgot about this. Or maybe I just never noticed it growing up. But yeah, here they have this beautiful brother moment until Steven passes out because he's drunk. And then, yeah, we go into this montage of them drilling at the firehouse. And it's this song called The Show Goes On by Bruce Hornsby. And the only way I can describe it is... if you've ever hired a videographer for a wedding in the 90s or the 80s, this would have been the song playing under like all of the picture montages of this couple at a wedding. This is bad. This was so bad. It was not Hans Zimmer, so I'm not going to put this on Hans Zimmer, but why is this song here?
I have no idea, but it's in terms of its like campy value and in terms of its homoerotic value, it is a montage right up there with Top Gun. Cause we just get like lots of shots of like them kind of like lovingly pouring water over their head for no reason and kind of like lots of wet shirts, you know, lots of.
I think they also turn the hose on and start drinking from the hose in there, I think.
Yeah. That's right. That's right, they do.
They're playing basketball, they're drilling, they're running the hose up the stairs to the roof of the firehouse. Yeah, I don't remember this song being so campy, but it started, I'm like, what? Is this a redo or something for the Blu-ray release? But,
No,
I never want to hear this song. It's such a transitional song between like 80s music and 90s music too. Mm-hmm. It's the definition of 1990 and 1991. And I'll never listen to the song again.
Which is a very kind of particular time of like, it's not quite the 80s. It's not quite got into the 90s. Cause it's like that thing. Like I know it's not like a glam metal song or whatever. But like a lot of rock songs and metal songs of that kind of time period, there's like the big 80s pomp, and then, you know, like by the time you get to like, yeah, like later on in 91, like Nirvana get big and like grunge gets big and stuff like that, but there's this kind of little bit.
Yeah, it's in just between. Before that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is where we get another sibling rivalry thing, because Steven doesn't like how Brian is running the hose up the stairs. And then Steven comes over and says, damn it, get the thing on your shoulder. And they race each other to the roof where we get the awesome. I don't know if it was improv or whatever, but Steven falls down on the stairs. Brian stops and looks back, and Steven says, run, damn you. And the only way Kurt Russell can, almost, if we're talking wrestling, almost Vince McMahon-like, run, damn you.
Yeah, it's a very fair point.
Yeah. But then we have a little argument on top, and we're getting this, at least I'm getting the sense that Brian is not loving the life of being a fireman. And Steven is thinking that, well, eventually you're going to quit eventually. Might be today, might be tomorrow, might be a year from now, but eventually, you know, you are going to quit because that's who you are. And we're starting to get the sense of that, I think, here.
Yeah. For sure. Although it does feel like the relationship does feel a little bit schizophrenic at this point, because you're like, with the kind of loving chat that they had after taking him home, and then like we've just watched this montage, and then that scene of them being kind of competitive but kind of cool with each other, and then they're kind of laughing on the rooftop, and then they're immediately bickering again. And you're like, oh, I kind of thought that they were kind of good now. Like I thought that's what the film had led me to. No, they're kind of not. All right, fair.
Yeah. And I guess like we could attribute that to maybe some revisions in the writing, but I've had those moments with my brother. And that's where I'm getting the chemistry between the two. It's like, yeah, you can go from laughing your ass off to wanting to punch each other in the face in like 5 seconds.
That's a fair point. Like I've had things like that with my little brother when we were doing that as well. So I suppose, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's very fair. But we get to go to another fire, just not long after this, like Brian and Stephen go to a fire, and we get more of like the fire acting like a monster that's just kind of like going around, going on, you know, is coming from under the door, then coming back out of the door, and all this kind of stuff going on. And Stephen goes into the fire, and Brian, like, I thinks Stephen dies when he goes into the fire, because we get this like slow-mo moment of like Brian like doing the kind of, you know, I know this is referencing a much later movie, but like it's a bit like that moment in Revenge of the Sith where he's like, no, but you know, Brian's going, Steven! And
because Steven runs in, they open the door up. Well, actually, right before this, the fire scene starts with the mother running to the fire truck saying, my baby is in there. I don't know about you. I hate this cliche and this trope in these movies. In action movies, when the mother or the parent is outside telling the cops or the firefighter, my baby is up there. You ran out of the building without grabbing your child.
Yeah.
Shame on you. And I see it all the time. It was in the first Spider-Man movie. My baby is up there.
Yeah.
Why are you down here?
What the fuck
are you
up
there? Protecting them or helping them. So that's why they're running in by themselves. Kurt Russell, he bursts the door down and he runs in right away. But Brian hesitates. He takes a moment. He catches his breath, and there's this big, like you said, almost mini explosion. And he does the whole Steven. And I think he loses him there. It's another callback moment to when he watched his father die and the fire engulfed the entranceways. The rest of the firemen come in later, acts with the fire hose. But he's sitting there thinking he just lost his brother again. The fire got his family again. The monster got his family again. But another great heroic slow-mo scene. Kurt Russell. I think it's the most iconic scene of this film.
Kurt Russell. It is literally the image on the poster.
Yep. Kurt Russell running out of the door, a jacket unbuttoned with his axe in his hand and the kid in his hand, saving the day again. Stephen Bolden McCaffey.
Apparently, 200 kids auditioned for that part to be in Kurt, because obviously they knew they were going to be on the poster, I suppose.
What was the auditioning criteria like for that?
I don't know. Kurt Russell just lifted a lot of kids that day. Just being like,
all right, Kurt Russell, how does this one feel? Do I have that kid? Do I have the child for you?
Too heavy? Too light? Is it good fit for you? Like, how's it going?
200 kids. Wow. That's
Kurt Russell lifts up kid number 178 and being like, Jesus Christ, how many more of these?
And always with his right hand. It was never with his left. He's not going to be, you know, again, this is a man's man movie. It's always going to be with my right hand. I just picture all the parents that are just trying to like sell their children to like, come on, get the role, please.
You're going to be on the poster. God damn it.
You better get this role or it's going to, you're not going to have a Christmas this year.
Oh, dude. One of the interesting things I read about as well, and then I was like, I looked out for it in the credits, was that, like, Kurt Russell and William Baldwin and Scott Glenn were all, like, trained up by, like, Chicago Fire Department kind of people, and, did some kind of fire training and stuff like that, and did a lot of their own stunts and are credited amongst the stuntmen.
Oh, really? I'm actually very glad to hear that. I love when we get these action movies, the actual actors doing the live stunts, but I think this is even better because this was live fire.
Yeah.
Which, as much as you prepare for, is still unpredictable.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No, I read a story that at one point that, there is a scene later on in the movie, basically the finale, where Scott Glenn's leg like caught on fire proper, and like he had to be like doused kind of out, you know, like could have been like seriously injured.
Oh jeez.
Yeah.
But that's awesome to hear that they were willing to do that. I always respect the big camera face actors who are willing to go about do that. And I think that was really kind of, again, the turn of this 90s era with people like Kurt Russell and Keanu Reeves, who were willing to actually go through the training of whatever action star, action film that they were in. Especially later on with Keanu, with John Wick. You see all those videos of him going through all the gun training and gun fu training or whatever.
Yeah, that's
so I always love that. I always love seeing that.
Yeah. And Keanu's like a big, like, lifelong martial arts enthusiast and like is training various martial arts and that as well. So like, I always respect that as well. But going back to the movie, this is kind of the point where Brian is like, nope, this isn't for me. I'm going to, like, we should have established that Alderman, offered him a role in his office to kind of be assistant to Don, De Niro's character, and which he had previously declined, but he now decides to accept this offer.
Yeah, because he realizes that he's never going to be, or at least he thinks he's never going to be that hero of a firefighter, so he wants to kind of take a back seat and joins De Niro as his assistant in this political espionage investigation that's been happening behind our backs as an audience. we knew that De Niro was, you know, searching for who's starting these fires or researching how these fires were started, but I guess it's becoming political because Alderman's like, hey, you got to help him get to the bottom of this.
Yeah. But at this point we're just kind of like, oh, okay, so this is a thing now. So we start falling. And I must say that, like, as much as I like Kurt Russell in this movie, I think De Niro is a joy in this movie. I really do. I really enjoy his performance. Apparently his character, Dom Rimmelgate, is like based on like a real guy who is also called Dom Rimmelgate. So that's quite fun. And then, like, he has a bunch of real fun scenes, and at this point in the movie, we get a totally random scene. A lot of this movie is totally random scenes, to be fair. But we do get a totally random scene of, like, Don just chewing this random firefighter out, and it's so fun.
It's how they, I wrote it down here. Like, we got to establish De Niro as a badass somehow. And he's not an action star anymore. This is not Taxi Driver De Niro, but we got to establish him as a major authority. So he's just going to chew out this probably probie firefighter in his office. And he's like, was this before or after you realized that there was an open gas line? Get the hell out of my office. This is the first day that Brian comes down and he's his new assistant. So it's a nice little introduction to your new boss, I think. but I do like their chemistry, too. This kind of this mentorship role that De Niro takes on with Brian, I think unwillingly too. But they go, so that's the morning for them. And then they go to prison, where we really don't know why they're going to prison until we meet up with Donald Sutherland, Donald Sutherland's character, Ronald Bartell, who is in prison and is about to supposedly get probation. But he set up a lot of fires in his young age, and De Niro is there to basically stop him. Shadow's there to stop him from being let out, if possible.
Yes, and this is another character that does not need to be in the movie, but I'm real glad that he is, because yes. Donald Sutherland is doing this weird, creepy, whispery voice, and he is like Hannibal Lecter, but instead of cannibalism, his thing is arson.
Yep. And this, you know, this movie came out, I think, 3 or 4 months after Silence of the Lambs did. So I feel a little bad for this movie, because this character and this whole coming to visit Ronald to get his insight on maybe who started the fire or how they're starting the fire. All of this was done masterfully with Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs. I'm like, oh no, I never realized this as a kid, but now I'm like, oh, they totally, I don't know, they didn't rip it off, but God, that's just poor timing for this movie. Yeah.
Because I think all the reviews at the time were like, oh, this Hannibal Lecter type that's in the movie for some reason.
Yep. Yep. But like you said, Donald Sutherland is great here. He's talking very, very softly with always this little tiny gleam of joy and happiness whenever he sees like a burnt doll or pictures of a burnt building or people being burned. There's just this twinkle in his eye, this happy little, like I was thinking, kind of like childish joy that comes over him. And it's really cool to see from him.
He is quite childlike in the role. But like, this is the one thing that he's not like Lecter, because he is considerably, as much as he's apparently a master criminal and master arsonist, he's not entirely all that clever, because he can only keep up the facade. As soon as Don presents him with the burnt doll and starts asking him about, like, and what do you want to do with this? And what do you want to do with the little girls? And what do you want to do with the old ladies? He's just like, burn them. I want to burn them. You know, like, and what do you want to do with everything? I want to burn it all. And then he's like, oh, whoops. Sorry. I shouldn't have said that in front of the parole board.
This parole board is pretty dumb too. They're like, they're just watching him, and he's like, oh yeah, I'll never do it again. And it looks like they're about to stamp approve.
Oh yeah, no, the parole board are idiots. Of like, he is the least convincing, like, no, I totally don't want to burn the, it's, you know, you could almost imagine them like playing with matches, being like, no, I don't want to burn anything at all. Like, yeah, okay, totally get it. Yeah, I think he's reformed, yeah.
Oh, thank God you were there, De Niro. We would have, crisis averted, thank you.
Yeah. Oh, spectacular stuff.
So after this scene, we get the introduction of him. I believe we get our second death at the theater.
Yes, this is random, the second assassination by fire, which for some reason is the, like I said, I watched this movie as a kid, but I probably not watched it in 20 years. And for some reason, this is the explosion that stuck in my mind the most. Like when he goes to the back door of the theater and then it's just like whoosh, like that image like always really stuck in my head with this movie. It was one of the kind of key scenes in my head that I always remembered.
Yeah. I always remembered the smoke kind of creeping in underneath the door, kind of like the door cracks just before, as if the fire knew, oh, hey, the guy is here.
Yeah. Like that's what I really, like that whole, I mean, this whole kind of scene and like, yeah, that little bit of like, yeah, it's still acting like this kind of monster being like, oh, I better hide. And the boom, kaboom!
Yeah! Again, it's a monster movie.
Yeah.
It's a monster movie. And I believe this is the first, because the explosion happened, the guy dies, and this is the first time that Steven sees Brian in his new investigative role.
Yes.
And they're kind of moving.
Don's assistant.
Yep, as Don's assistant. And then they move to the morgue where they are examining both the bodies, I believe.
And for those playing the Ron Howard drinking game at home, we get the Clint Howard cameo here, so you can all take a shot.
The standard Clint Howard cameo. Love it. Such a unique looking guy with that partially bald head. You can't miss him in any film, especially a Ron Howard film. But yeah, here we learn that the accelerant that is being used is a chemical called tryptochlorate, which again, Clint Howard has a line in there like, none of us knew what it was. And Robert De Niro, of course, is there and like, oh, it's tryptochlorate. It's an accelerant. Come on, guys. And I'm thinking, come on, guys, you're doctors, you're scientists. You should know this stuff, especially if you're in a morgue trying to figure out the cause of death and things. But yeah, so now we're getting the hint as to kind of how these fires are starting.
Yeah, for sure.
Because these people, at least the people who have died so far, have had, I from what I gather, they had some like tryptochlorate on them that triggered the backdraft. Is that correct?
I think so. Like it seems like it was like in his kind of top shirt pocket or something.
There was something on them that. Yeah. Maybe that's why we saw the smoke underneath the door, because the fire could smell the chemical and it was like, oh, he's about to open the door. Let's go back in.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Also, the other thing I wanted to point out about this scene is like, Clint Howard totally could have pointed out that like little bit on the corpse's chest while the corpse was lying down. There was literally no need for Brian to lift the corpse up onto his side. It seemed like it was like a first day prank.
Yeah. Or, you know, now that you mentioned that, I'm trying to think of like every Law and Order or CSI episode. I don't recall them ever facing the body downward. Maybe that's like a standard positioning practice, maybe? I don't know. I like the prank theory. Let's call it the prank theory. But yeah, Brian is just holding the dead body and he's not used to it. He's like, oh God.
It's just desperately
so disgusting. Yep. Yeah. And then we're figuring out, okay, we're getting an idea of how these fires are started. And then we kind of transition to a party scene where Brian gets to, get back with Jennifer, who we find out is the assistant to Alderman. And, you know, they start drinking, they get off the party, they go to the party boat, and they go over to where Brian works at the firehouse, where we get one of the best pickup doomy lines I've ever heard. I don't know about you, but when Jennifer says, why don't you show me your fire truck? I was like, well, okay. You know, as a kid, I never picked up on stuff like that. But as an adult, it's like, wow, you were just come right out and say it. Why don't you? Jesus. Well, the next thing you should have said, like, well, pull your hose out or something. I don't know. But yeah, they have a little scene there at the top on top of one of the fire trucks. And this is all happening while Station 17, Steven, is taking all of his team up to a what seems to be soon a burning floor of a hotel or apartment complex. And it's funny because whenever they burst down a door to see if fire is behind it, that's the inclination that, oh, hey, more sex is happening on top of the fire truck and we keep cutting back and forth. So if you can picture like the axe bursting down the door of the hotel, then we quickly cut back to Brian and Jennifer having sex and you can imagine it's like, ooh, it's another thrust. Haha, funny.
Oh, but we should mention the apex of this scene. When we're kind of doing this kind of cutting back and forth, there is a brilliant moment, best edit in the whole movie, when Kurt Russell says the line, "She's hot and smoky, but not rolling yet," and then hard cut back to the sex.
Yup. And again, our young childish minds had no idea what he was talking about. I thought he was talking about the fire growing up. That is not what that line is referencing.
Run hard, you big pervert.
Yep. Oh, me and my brother were so innocent as children.
Yeah, no, I didn't pick it up as a kid at all. Like, nope. I definitely didn't laugh at that line as a kid. I was just like, oh,
it's hilarious.
It's so funny. Watching this. But then the fire people at his station are called, so we get an episode of Coitus Interruptus just as matters are reaching a climax.
Yep, things are about to end, and all of a sudden the alarm goes off, and the fire truck that they are having sex on is called, and is actually called to the building that Station 17 is already at, so they get to quickly dress themselves while on top of a fire truck driving through the streets of Chicago. But then we cut back to the apartment complex, and I guess we should have mentioned that, you know, Axe is kind of acting a little strange and saying, hey, we should wait for more people, we should wait for more stations, or hey, let me go down this hallway. And Steven's not having it. He's saying, let's get this done and out of here, and he goes to the left while he orders Axe to go to the right hallway or whatever.
Yeah.
But then we, you know, they're checking doors, they're banging down doors while Brian's having sex. And, Tim fails to check one of the doors, bursts it open, and the huge explosion that engulfs him in fire, very badly, to the point where all the firemen come over and they try to put out the fire that he is doused in. Yeah. Yes, they wheeled him to the hospital, and Brian shows up there. Steven shows up, and he has a little altercation with Axe that we really can't hear because it's through the window. But then Brian is starting to ridicule Steven, saying that you're his commanding officer. You should have been with him at all times. Why weren't you? And they get into another brotherly scuffle, a little bit more physical this time. And I always remember after, you know, the punching and all the grabbing, just remembering Kurt Russell being pushed up against the wall with his fellow firefighters and just seeing the intensity of his cheeks shaking back and forth. I will remember that from my childhood, and I'll remember that to this day of just how intense he was in this scene. I love it.
Oh, yeah. He's so intense. And it's the proper kind of brooding hero moment of just being like, you know, he has that kind of crumpled look in his face because, like, you get both in the hospital and just before they go to the hospital, you get this kind of shot of like the fire crew just like looking really kind of disappointed in him and kind of disapproving and just kind of that kind of thing of like, oh no, the boys have lost faith in their leader.
Yeah, he's looking back and everyone, you know, is giving him that solemn look and then slowly walking away. Yeah. they're losing faith in their lieutenant. So,
yeah.
Which kind of, yeah.
And then, like, as much as Tim was apparently Brian's best friend, we just like don't give a fuck about him now. It's just like, yeah. Like, cause he's just, he's just still alive, but then we do not get an update. I presume he dies because we do not get an update on him afterwards.
We never do find out if he is living the rest of his life as the English patient or if he died. I don't know.
Nope.
But you're right. We screwed Tim.
And we apparently no longer care about Tim. We'll roll on as the movie rolls on because
absolutely.
This is a movie that just fires subplots at you and then just immediately drops characters for no reason, even though they've previously been seen as important. But hey ho, we've got more fun with Robert De Niro. And I do want to mention this scene because it's a random scene that adds nothing to the movie, really. But it's just Robert De Niro's attitude in this scene is real fun to me, where like Alderman picks him up in his car. Alderman is giving him all this shit about the investigation. And Don is clearly not listening to him at all, just offers him some Chinese sponge cake that he's just chewing away on. It's just a real joy to me.
Yeah, and he's talking. Alderman is like, you gotta figure out what's going on. I mean, it's all being murdered because they're all connected. And Don's playing coy. At first, how the scene is portrayed, it almost seems like Don is not that intelligent. But in the end, I think he's just playing coy here. And I think he has some suspicion because Alderman all of a sudden lists every single name of the three people that have been killed by these backdrafts. And Don has the great line of just, oh, I didn't realize that the name of the third victim was released to the public. And then they just hold there. No one speaks or says anything, and the scene ends. Great. That's well done. Well done, sir.
Well played, Don. You were playing the long game.
again, this, now we're going into like police dramatization where this is an investigation.
Oh, yes. This is the police procedural part of the movie. This should be mentioned as well. So in this season, we will be talking about a bunch of different movies. When I drew up this season, I presumed that Tombstone would be the longest movie that we are covering. But for some reason, this movie at 137 minutes is a whole 3 minutes longer than Tombstone.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Really?
Wow. It is the longest movie. Like, there is no other movie that is longer in this season. There is movies that are close to it because Stargate's 2 hours and 13. Executive Citizen's decision is 2 hours and 10. And like I said, Tombstone's 2 hours and 14 minutes. But no, at 2 hours and 17 minutes, don't know how it got to this length. This is the longest film we will cover this season and the longest film we have covered so far on the show.
Well, I'm glad that it's a two-man booth here and I'm on this one. I watched Tombstone a couple of months ago. That one felt very long to me. I am shocked that it's shorter than this film, because to me, this film, it clips by for the most part.
Because it's stuff with so much stuff, then you're constantly being like, and why is this in the movie? And what and what's that subplot doing there? And why does it need this character? You know, it's fun to watch, but like there's lots of stuff that you're just like, this is kind of confusing. But anyway, we're in the procedural part of the movie. This is the Law and Order part of the movie, whatever.
Yeah, we don't, it's going to be a while until we get a big, actually, I think till the climax, until we get another big fire scene. We get a little brief explosion here in a couple minutes, but the next big fire scene is at the end. We start diving into, Don and Brian kind of figuring out all the connections between all of these unnamed political, financial people, all paired with Stephen trying to hook back up with his wife and trying to get back with his family.
That is right. And we get another kind of tasteful lovemaking scene with Stephen and Helen. But we should also cover the fact that around this time, we get the best line in the movie, where like Dawn is talking to Brian and Dawn randomly starts a fire in a burnt out hotel room. And he is explaining, because up until this point, we've been hearing the fire, we've been seeing the fire kind of running away and then exploding, and we've been hearing the fire roar and all this kind of stuff. And it's just like, oh, so this is being presented to the audience. The fire is some sort of kind of monster. But then we're like, oh no, the characters believe it is a monster because Dawn says it breathes, it eats, and it hates. Establishing that, yes, in this universe, fire is a literal monster.
That is out. It is a naturalistic monster that only knows one thing, and that's to eat and then go to eat more. That's all it knows. That's all it breathes. That's all it believes in. And that's all it wants to do.
Yep.
So the comparisons to Jaws are just tremendous with this film and their portrayal of fire. And again, oh, absolutely. I love it. I freaking love it. Now I was reading.
Dawn's Great White.
Now I was reading that, the inaccuracies of this movie when asked by real firefighters, that there are really two things that are the big two disagreements. The one is this, is that fire investigations, yes, there was a time where it was believed that fire is kind of a living thing, but the whole investigative idea behind figuring out how fires start, you don't approach it with the idea that, oh, fire is living and it needs to breathe and it needs to consume or stuff like that. The second one is all of these big fire scenes that we have in this film, the cinematography of it, the lighting of it, the visuality of it is not realistic, because in real life, all these big fires, you would not be able to see a damn thing in the building. But of course, we obviously do, because this is a movie.
Yes. And I feel like, in terms of like the criticism of the portrayal of fires and firefighting, I feel like the second point is generally forgiven, of being like, yes, we understand this is a movie. Oh, yeah. We understand we need to see the actors. We understand that it would not be very interesting if you couldn't see the actors and the action and, you know, the stunts going on or whatever. So the first point about the fire being a living, breathing monster that needs to consume people and just wants to kill, and hates certain people, you know, like really, you know, has a vendetta against people. I think that is a bigger sticking point of like, it just doesn't make any goddamn sense. Like even in a movie context, it doesn't make a goddamn lick of sense.
It doesn't have a brain. It's a scientific thing that yes, needs oxygen, but it's not, there's no emotion or vendetta towards anything.
Yeah, but like in this universe, that is not true, because yes. Dawn is like, you see how the fire is tracing up that ceiling? That's not because of science. That's because the fire wants to do that.
And William Baldwin, acting in this scene, he is just entranced. He is shocked. His mouth is hanging wide open. Great. Love it.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Yeah. Oh boy, what happened? Oh, then we have the, like you said, we have the tasteful, a night scene between, Stephen and Helen. And then the next morning, Stephen is, you know, trying to get with his son, make breakfast in bed, trying to, you know, be a family again. And Helen's like, no, you take too many risks. It's not fair to Sean. You need to get out of here, which I wrote down on my notes like, well, it's his kid too. Yeah. I think he has some say in the matter, but fine, whatever. He goes. Cause that's what Stephen would do. He knows the risks, and I guess doesn't want to put him through what he went through growing up. And then really Brian, I think, kind of blows blows the roof off of the investigation and figures out the whole connection between everything and Alderman. Am I correct in that?
Pretty much, because, like, yeah, not long after that, we get a real weird scene of, like, it's kind of portrayed that, like, Alderman or Marty, is, like, dead.
In a
chair. Yes. And then he's just turned around and he's being real creepy and he's got these files in front of him. And then we get the tip off, from Jennifer and the connections are made of, like, all the guys are, like, finance guys and all this kind of stuff. And, they're connected to Alderman, who has, like, the task force that he has set up to kind of plug the holes in the firehouses he shut down, the task force is, like, an on paper only task force and actually has been siphoning the money and all this kind of stuff. Yep. It's incredibly convoluted and again, doesn't need to be there, but it is. And then yes, Brian goes to pick Ronald's brain. Again, Ronald doesn't really need to be there, but again, this is a fun scene because Donald Sutherland is just doing his thing and being real creepy and real fun. And we get more stuff of, like, the fire being presented as a monster where, Ronald says to Brian, "Did the fire look at you?" And that just, which is,
it did.
That's really intense and funny. Like you said before we started recording, Brian basically, he's only there to kind of turn a light bulb on Brian's head of, like, he kind of points out, like, oh, it's got to be somebody who has access to these chemicals and somebody who hates fire, and who would have access to those chemicals and who would hate fire? It must be a fireman,
right? Whoa. And there's only, like, 5 firemen in the entire city of Chicago.
It's
and my brother is one of them. But he remembers the canisters that he saw on the boat from our first scene on the boat with his brother. So he goes there just to remind himself of, hey, that's right, I saw them here. And then his brother stops by and they have this kind of strange, weird altercation. No fists fly, but it definitely seems like Steven's going to pull out a gun or a bat or something and beat his brother's brains in, because it seems like he's behind all of these fires that have happened, all these murders that have happened to these financial people. We actually failed to mention that someone tried to take out Alderman as well in his house just before Brian goes to Ronald, and Robert De Niro kind of saves everyone. He gets stabbed by a fence or whatever. But yeah, all of these big shots are being targeted by someone.
Yeah,
again,
it's a shame
we
did fail to mention that, because that's another sterling bit of acting from De Niro, where he's impaled by a metal fence, and he's like, "Ah, I think I need a little help here."
Yeah, a line I've always remembered watching this as a kid, guys. That I think I got a little problem, man. It's a badass line of, like,
it is a badass
if it was
line.
Me, I'd be like, ow, 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 ow. But here he's like,
De Niro's underselling of this is beautiful.
It's wonderful. It's great.
Brilliant.
But we're on the boat. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
When we cut back to the boat, we're coming back to, like, the scene on the boat. I have written in my notes here, Steven acting creepy because the plot says so. Because it just seems so contrived that he's just, like, acting in this such a weird way that we've never seen him act before. And it's just like, oh, you're just, like, really trying real hard to make him a red herring. Okay, I suppose we've got to do this now.
Yeah. And part of me was thinking, that was this a rewrite that we just failed to edit this scene? Because it seems like the way Kurt Russell is playing this, it seems like he is the guy who's been doing all of this, and how he's delivering it. He's saying things like, well, how am I doing here? Well, I'm along for the ride. what are you doing here? Huh? And just his body posture. I feel like at one point he was supposed to be in the script, the killer, the fire starter. Turns out though it's not.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely. We can't have Kurt Russell, who is our big action hero of the 90s, as the villain here. So we make this out to be Axe, Scott Glenn's character. He's the one who's been doing all of this because all of these deals that have gone down have led to the deaths of several firemen over the years, and Axe just wanted to put a stop to it. Kind of in a shitty way, blowing up buildings and stuff, but could have been a little bit more subtle, I think, but you know.
Yeah, I did want to point out as well, though, like when it is revealed that, like, it's kind of revealed to us as an audience that Axe is obviously the person who's behind the fires, we have like this weird series of scenes of like stare-offs between Brian and Axe, and then Steven and Axe. Like, there's like three separate moments where it's just like, we're just watching a stare off of just being like, well, I know he did it. He definitely did it. I know that you know that I did it.
I don't know if it's like an unspoken brotherhood that they were trying to portray here, but it's all no dialogue. They're just staring at each other. And I think you hear a little bit, because Brian is figuring out that this guy was the guy who assaulted them in, Alderman's house and was burned by the outlet. So he has the little burn mark on his shoulder. So I think you like hear the flashback sound effect of him screaming. It's just all back and forth. As I'm thinking about this, though, how Axe wants to take out these guys for killing firemen, because he says it on the roof. They're the big climactic scene of this movie, the Station 17 is called to this big chemical fire at this big warehouse, and on the roof is Station 17, and Axe, Brian, Steven, they're all there, and Axe is saying he was killing our brothers for money. If you're going to take out these people for killing your firefighter brothers, why would you do it with fire that could potentially kill more brothers? Why not just shoot them? Because the plot, maybe?
Yes, because the plot. It's a bit like, why go to all the effort of, like, it seems like he went to great deals of effort to set up Alderman as well, but then he attacks him, which immediately takes him off the list of suspects.
Right.
I don't know. I'm not sure what Axe's plan was particularly. I'm not sure that the script knows either. Like, nope. I mean, it goes off in so many directions and has so many massive holes in it.
He does it by fire because it's a movie called Backdraft, and yes, we need fire and explosions. That's why.
Yeah. And I gotta admit, all these contrivances really entertain me. Like the fact that like when they go, before they go, you know, get to the rooftop, the fire truck that Brian is in, that is in the fire truck behind Bull and Axe, like it tips over. Just like it crashes just so that Brian has to run to the scene of the fire. Like, it, you know, like all these plot contrivances really amuse me.
It's an unnecessary stunt. I completely forgot about it, but yeah, you're right. They're driving to the burning building and there's a little scuffle in traffic. The fire truck, it flips over, but everyone's okay and everyone just runs to the building. No, it doesn't need to be there. It was just a random thing.
I think part of what entertains me about the movie is just all the things that don't need to be there, but are for whatever reason.
It's there. It's there because it's entertainment. It doesn't make sense, but it's there.
Ah, dear. Also, like, I wrote down in my notes, basically, they have this conversation of, you know, like the big reveal of like, you know, why Axe was doing this. and Bull is kind of grilling him about it. And I've just written down in my notes, questionable having this out on a fiery rooftop.
You think if he was a good lieutenant, Stephen, you would have, you know, stopped him from going on this ride and saying, hey, wait here, we're going to have a talk when we get back.
No, but it's just less dramatic if they do it at the fire station than on top of a chemical plant that is on fire.
That is all on fire, encompassing fire. And especially when Stephen is getting on top of the roof, there is someone up there saying, hey, they want us off the roof. Let's go. So now it's the perfect time to be like, hey, let's have this really in-depth, life-changing discussion right here, right now. I mean, it sounds very, you know, action-y, Kurt Russell-y to me. Why not?
Why not, indeed?
Yeah. But the roof caves in and Brian is told to run to the side, but for dramatic purposes runs to the opposite end of the roof to get to the elevator chute where it's a terrible dummy that is being thrown down an elevator chute.
Yes, he's blown out of a window dummy is blown out of a window and then falls into the flooded elevator shaft.
Yep. And then because of all the flooding and all the water that's coming in from the fire trucks outside, the level of the water keeps rising and he's being risen up to what seems to be a gas line fire. But Stephen comes in and saves him, jumps to turn off the gas line, saving his brother. Again, I'm not sure of how the physics works with elevators, but I'm almost certain water could creep in between the cracks of the doors. But, you know, again, for plot purposes,
don't think about physics when it comes to this movie. This movie has no regards to any sort of science.
The scientists don't know what
pathology or physics or, you know, chemistry, whatever. Yeah. It doesn't, there's no, we can't fuck about with that. You know, we'll be here all day.
No, but, the brothers, they're running through the burning building and the cinematography here, the stunts, the visual effects, the use of fire. I love in this climax. There's explosions and they're running through these explosions. It's awesome. I love this. I love this scene. Axe comes in and takes out Brian with the butt end of his axe, and we think we're about to have an axe off between Axe and Bull.
Yeah, like I kind of remembered, you know, there was a vague memory of kind of like a little bit of disappointment that we do not get a fire axe fight.
Like, no.
Because, I mean, that would just be the ultimate topper to this movie of being like, and we get a fire axe fight. And in the middle of a fire in a chemical plant. Oh, yeah.
You know what? Maybe they do it in Backdraft 2. Maybe we need to check that out and see if they actually do. If they do that, I will watch Backdraft 2. I highly doubt it.
Ah, yeah. Oh, dear. Yeah. The weirdest thing about Backdraft 2, though, is usually these direct-to-video sequels that are made decades after the original has none of the original cast members, whereas Backdraft 2 does have both William Baldwin and Donald Sutherland.
Who, William Baldwin, in that trailer for Backdraft 2, I thought it was Alec Baldwin. I thought for sure it was. But reading the plot synopsis of that movie, it sounds like Brian and Ronald are barely in the thing. They're just there for name value only.
Yeah. I think they're in it for mere minutes. Like, it's just brief cameos, and like the whole story centers around the grown up Sean.
But yeah, they lower their axes because they're about to lay into each other, but they put them down, and it's an interesting kind of moment in an action movie where you don't have the final battle between the villain and our lead action star. We have kind of a tender moment here where his axe is put down, Stephen puts his axe down, and Axe says, I just couldn't let it go, Bull. And, you know, I always enjoyed that of this movie, that it doesn't end in, you know, a big Stallone muscle versus muscle type fist fight or something like that. It's just kind of a nice human tender moment, that quickly gets interrupted, I guess, by the main villain of the movie, the fire, because platform, the platform that they're standing on collapses. And we get another, if you go, we go moment where Steven is holding on to Axe. Axe is engulfed in flame, because all the flames down below. Brian is on the other side. He's trying to save himself. He's dangling there. And he watches his brother, Steven. They have this staring moment where Steven knows, yep, I'm about to let go of the railing, because I'm not letting go of this person. That's not our motto. So he lets go and they both fall. Axe falls to his death. Steven kind of impales himself, but lands on a secondary railing, kind of closer to the fire, but he's still alive, not doing well. And Brian, in a very kind of origin superhero-like moment, climbs down, jumps down, and kind of starts saving his brother. The rest of the fire team is trying to come in, but there's explosions going off all around all their heads, and they lose the fire hose, and the fire hose is going crazy. And Brian is finally gonna have that moment. He drops all the way down to the ground. He grabs the fire hose, douses all the firemen.
Wait a second, because like you mentioned that, in the scene with Axe and Bull, that we do not get a climactic battle, but we don't get it between human characters, but we do get a climactic battle, because before Brian grabs the hose, he has a dramatic stare off the fire.
And it's an amazing shot. I'm actually angry that I completely forgot about it. But yeah, the fire is slowly coming in on the roof of this room that they're in. And the sounding sound like it's roaring like a Tyrannosaurus Rex. It's pretty goddamn epic, I'm going to be honest.
Oh, but yeah, it is. It is. It is like, like you say, it's like roaring like a dragon. And then just Brian stares it directly in the whatever. It doesn't have eyes, but like the imaginary eyes that he can see in the fire of the dragon that's behind it, obviously. They have a moment, and then he grabs that hose that's previously been out of control. He just leaps on it and takes it under control, as if it's like a kind of out of control snake or something. And so that's our climactic battle, and he takes out that fire. He douses that fire.
He takes it out. It tries to come out from behind him. It's coming down at his feet, and he's like, no! And if this was a superhero movie, this would be the moment where our hero embraces their powers and accepts the role of being the superhero, because this is Brian's call again to become a firefighter for the rest of his life. So, it's a great scene. Kurt Russell, Steven, he's being helped out. And as Brian is taking on the monster, he has this great line. He's like, look at him. That's my brother. God damn it.
I wrote that quote down in my notes as well, because another one of the best lines in the movie.
And it's only amplified. I love Hans Zimmer as a composer. He's one of my favorites. He's done all of my favorite comic book movies. He's done a lot. He's done Lion King, done a ton.
Yeah. He's done a lot of great Zimmer work with Christopher Nolan, obviously, like not just in the court, he's done Batman movies, but like in Inception and stuff like that. So like,
absolutely.
He's done some great stuff.
Interstellar, I think, is his masterpiece. Here, this is standard Zimmer, the swelling of the brass, just the climactic theme, it's great. It only amplifies the scene so much more. After he fights the fire monster, Steven is loaded up into an ambulance. I can never say that word correctly. Ambulance.
Yeah.
And then Brian is there with him, and you know that this is happening because it looks like his guts are pouring out of his side. That's how badly he was impaled. But they have that moment of just, hey, we know what's happening. But Steven, to the end, Kurt Russell, he's saying, the fire never got me. I never let it get me. Because that's his main driving force of being a fireman. He's taking it on. He's not going to let it get to him like his father did. Or he did many years in the past, however it was.
Yeah.
That's his thing. And then he unfortunately passes away.
But not before he gets Brian to agree to perpetuate a cover-up of three murders.
Right.
Because it'll make the fire department look bad.
Don't tell him about X. Don't tell him about anything, really. Don will understand. Just don't tell him. Let's take down that politician together. Yeah, that's right. And apparently he does, because our next scene is our two investigators interrupting a press conference of aldermen, saying like, hey, you orchestrated everything. And they throw their findings and investigation files on the table, and the press grabs them. And Brian has that great comeback line where he throws his lines back in his face, and we see that glimmer in your eye. Yeah, it's your career going down the toilet or whatever it was.
And just before that, actually, we get like a parade.
Was that before?
Yeah, so the movie ends in a weird way where it's kind of like, oh well, he's died. That's the end of the movie. Oh no, we get a parade for Bull. In his honor. Oh, that's the end of the movie. No, actually, we get De Niro and William Baldwin wrapping up the political mystery that doesn't need to be there.
That's the end of the movie. Right?
Oh no, wait. We got one more scene where like Brian has to treat a probie just like he was treated as a probie to prove that he is now a real firefighter. And that is the actual end of the movie.
That's
God,
true.
Why is this movie like Return of the King? What the fuck is
That's right. I wrote down here with that parade and everything, you know, this is for Axe and this is for Bull. Did this happen for the other firefighters who died? Did they get the Hans Zimmer swelling score and the funeral? Did they get the parade? I feel like this is just for the two people here in this movie. But they talk so much about all these firefighter deaths. I'm like, does that happen with every firefighter death? Or is it just these two because they're the main character?
It is just these two. These are the two most important firefighters, apart from Kurt Russell's dad, who is himself most important firefighters in Chicago history.
So, yep, as you said, they drive off into the sunset, called to another fire, and Brian has that kind of parental mentorship moment with the new probie of you're doing it wrong, and fastens his coat properly, and they drive off into the Chicago sunset, and we have an interesting factoid that comes on the screen that says there are over... I guess at this time, there are over 1,200,700 active firefighters in the U.S. today, and then credits. And I remember reading that this time going, okay,
yeah,
cool.
It is a weird stat. It's just kind of, cause you kind of feel like, oh, you get that factoid and then you're like, you know, like, then you feel like, oh, it might come up like, oh, like, you know, off which, you know, like this is how many kind of firefighter deaths happen per year. And then maybe mention how much they get paid and the unfairness of that or something. It feels like there's more statistics that should come after. And it's just like, no. It's just a flat kind of like there's over 1.2 million firefighters in the U.S.
Yeah. It's like, okay. Cool. There are also a lot of cops in the country. There are a lot of teachers that work. There are a lot of people on the planet. What are you trying to tell us here? Yeah, I thought there was going to be like, you know, here's how many are active. Here are many deaths that happen. We should support them, or we should donate to them, or
yeah.
Something, but nothing.
Yeah, like you do feel like, you know, it's kind of, it's going somewhere in terms of like, maybe these are the deaths. This is how much they get paid. You know, like, if you want to support your local firehouse, you know, like, call this number, you know, like, something. But it's just like, no, it's just this flat kind of like, this is how many they are. And that, cool, I guess. I now know how many firefighters there were in the U.S. in 1991.
Or tell us how, like, how many fires actually happened in the year or whatever. But no, nothing. And the credits roll and we get another one of those very, very bad 1990s, 80s songs again from whoever that guy
Bruce
was.
Hornsby. We get more Bruce Hornsby.
Bruce Hornsby. Yeah. I just wanted to put him out of my mind. But yeah, he has another song here and I feel really bad for Hans Zimmer to be associated with a soundtrack that has songs from this guy. And his band with
Bruce
Hans
Hornsby, or as he's probably known, poor man Kenny Loggins.
God, so bad.
Oh dear.
Yeah, but that's Backdraft.
That is Backdraft in the books. That is our thoughts and opinions on it. I hope you've enjoyed listening. If you want to give us any feedback, please do. You can always hit us up on @90s_all if you want to hit us up on Twitter. If you want to give us a review, you can on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, you know, wherever you listen to podcasts, you know, subscribe. And if you are giving us a review, please give us 5 stars on the review, because the way these algorithms work for podcasts, if you give anything less than that, the algorithm thinks we are awful. And we're really not. So 5 stars. But it just leaves me to thank my special guest co-host, Caleb. Thank you very much. And do you want to tell people where they can see you elsewhere, where they can hit you up on social media and stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Just, you know, algorithms with this. I use the YouTube algorithm. I have a YouTube channel called Caleb Watches Movies, where I select from any of the movies that I own and I do a quick little about 10-minute review of each movie, and it's all done at random. It's not done, you know, me picking them off the shelf. I have a random generator where I just randomly pick them. So at one point I'll be seeing a masterpiece like Shawshank Redemption, and then the next day I'll be watching a very shitty independent horror film, a title that I would have no idea where it comes from, but that's what I do. If you can head over there and hit subscribe, that definitely helps me out. We're working our way, or at least I'm working my way towards 3,000 subscribers. We just passed 2,000 subscribers a couple months ago. Got well over 400 movie reviews on there for you to choose from. So odds are you probably find a review, my opinions of a movie that you probably like or have heard of before on there. So please head over there. Caleb Watches Movies. That's where you'd find me.
Excellent. And we definitely recommend all of our listeners to do that and go and check out your videos. And we also recommend, listener, that you come back next week when we will be talking about Tombstone. But until then, see ya.